The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to another wonderful evening at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I have a couple of requests. One is that you silence your phones and any other materials. I had forgotten to do mine, so I am doing mine, and I hope you'll do yours as well. The second is to ask you to contribute as you're able to the Free Library to support, in particular, their after-school events. Obviously, with COVID, the real casualty are our children who had their education interrupted, and anything we can do to help bridge that gap and to help them to catch up, I think it well merits our support. I also encourage you to talk to your Philadelphia politicians to tell them about the importance of the Free Library and how critical our branch system is in terms of enhancing both education and the enjoyment of all of our citizens. Tonight, we have Sir Simon Sharma, who's written Foreign Bodies, which I encourage you to read. It is a perfectly timed book dealing with pandemics, vaccines, and the health of nations, at a time when we're all thinking about getting our flu shots and our COVID boosters and our RSV shots. Among the many books and things that he has written, you might not be aware of it, I encourage you to think about, is that you might want to explore in the Q&A is why we like tough guys in politics was a subject. And the whole question of nature and science and the intersection that takes place and our resistance to new techniques and new vaccines and new methods of medical treatment. All are issues that are timely and important, and all are explored in this excellent book. Sir Simon will be interviewed tonight by Macon Scott from our own Philadelphia's WHYY. She is a specialist in health and science and a host of the show, The Pulse. And so I encourage you to give them both a warm Philadelphia welcome.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here, and thank you for being here. I want to start with a small anecdote, and I'll keep it brief. But in 2019, I found myself moderating an event with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who at the time, I have to admit, I was not all that familiar with. And the event was titled, How to Survive a Pandemic. Everybody was talking about, you know, the 100th anniversary of the flu, and pandemics were this big topic. And we had this evening, we talked about all these different pandemics, and not for 1 minute did it occur to me that I might actually experience a pandemic. I don't know why that didn't register. And then reading your book, it is so humbling to take this long view of history and to realize there's almost no escaping that. And I don't know how we had deluded ourselves into thinking we might. But talk a bit about that long view you took during the pandemic on pandemics.
Yeah, well, you know, repression's a wonderful thing, really.
Yes, it works.
So it does work, really. No, I think historically, actually, there was one particular infectious disease, obviously bubonic plague, which lasted centuries, really, from the 14th century when it arrived in Europe and carried on until the late 17th century. So there was a kind of not just an inherited memory, but people's expectations was that this would something that, you know, they would be visited by with absolutely devastating results. Venice lost a whole third of its population in 1631. So, but then the kind of story very often is of sudden and unexpected things coming down the pike. I mean, smallpox, which occupies a fair bit of the early part of the book, you know, only really starts to make an impact in Europe in the late 17th century, and then it really one in six people die of it suddenly. And rather like COVID-19, it induces a sort of spectacularly sudden sense of panic and terror and social disintegration, and especially, you know, in at a time when the immune system was completely unknown and people didn't understand the transmission of pathogens at all. So the sense of what to do and where we were going, and the sermons get more incandescent, and people are blaming smallpox on the commission of dreadful sins by all and sundry, and that sort of syndrome occurs. So very often these things happen seemingly with startling impact. The other, you know, extraordinary moment is an Asian story which I tell in the book, mm-hmm. when bubonic plague, the Black Death, returns, appearing in Guangzhou, Canton, as it was then, and Hong Kong in 1892. Again, an absolutely incredibly frightening thing. And nearly 30 million people die of bubonic plague between the early 1890s and the late 1920s. And that's a pandemic, really, we've kind of forgotten about. So there's a tremendously breathless sense of catching up. The difference between the response to smallpox and the response to bubonic plague in the 1890s is that the latter happened after, really, the immune system had been discovered, although microbiology had a very hard time persuading the medical profession that it should be taken seriously.
Now, to talk about smallpox, what were some of...
As we must.
Yes, we must. What were some of the thoughts? Now, you mentioned sinful behavior being a potential cause. What were some other thoughts out there? What did people think? How did you get it? How was it spread? What were some of the popular ideas floating around?
Well, it was assumed to be, you know, transmitted by some sort of human contact, almost certainly respiratory, which mm-hmm. was, you know. So they had that was not the problem. Interestingly, smallpox did not, however, trigger the kind of quarantines, really. The quarantine system that had been adopted in the 17th and 16th century was on the assumption, really, that bubonic plague was brought in cargoes. The assumption about smallpox, of course, also there were the theory of miasma was still very current. Miasma is the sense in which infectious diseases actually are caused by vapors arising from the rotting of organic materials, vegetable materials, untended cemeteries, and so on. So the toxins really kind of, you know, rise or are caused to their rise is acceleration to the atmosphere by atmospheric disturbances, you know, made a weather forecast lethal. Not that there were particular weather forecasts then. The real issue, an extraordinary kind of, you know, leap in the dark, was when, you know, as I describe it, it was proposed, it was observed by this extraordinary woman, Mary Wortley Montagu, the wife of the British ambassador in Constantinople, in 1718, that those she met, particularly women, had not suffered from smallpox, that people didn't die of smallpox, and they weren't, if they survived, disfigured or made to go blind by smallpox. And when on inquiring in the seraglios of pashas and the elite classes of the Ottoman Empire, including the seraglio of the Sultan, she was told that this business of inoculation, which later was called variolation, but not in the 18th century, by which you took some poisoned matter, pus, from an infected living body and transferred it into your own arm or head or foot by abrading the skin or making an incision, And this was so staggeringly counterintuitive. She actually inoculated, she was so strongly of the belief empirically acquired that this really would work, that she inoculated her six-year-old son, Edward, when her husband was away. I don't think she was particularly confident that he would think this is a good idea. And it worked. He had a mild case of smallpox, very few pustules, they all dropped off. Her brother had died of it. She'd gone through a catastrophically traumatic case of smallpox. She had been a famous beauty and was badly disfigured by the attack of smallpox. And that was her determination. When she went back to England, she inoculated her three-year-old daughter, at which point there was an extraordinary blowback who said, what kind of mother is this that would introduce poison matter into the otherwise perfectly healthy body of their child?
And if I could interject for a second, it is a gigantic intellectual leap, yeah, as you said,
yeah,
and counterintuitive. Yeah. So where can we trace this idea that this might work?
Well, it's a fantastically, to me, when I was doing the research on this, illuminating paradox. On the one hand, there's this tremendous belief in empirically accumulated knowledge, mm-hmm, that, and Mary Wollard Montagu was not the first to say this. There were two Greek physicians, Emmanuel Timoni and Giacomo Pilarini, who'd also observed this to be the case. They'd actually seen elderly Greek ladies in the Ottoman Empire whose profession it was to go around inoculating children in particular. And so in some sense there was a respect for statistically measurable success of what had been empirically seen. The remarkable thing is that the Royal Society, this august, highly elite institution of scientists sitting in London, was prepared to entertain and accept these observations and publish them in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, even though they came not at all from Western science. They came from Turkey and Syria and India and North Africa. And the famous case when smallpox comes to Boston in 1721, Cotton Mather, the Puritan divine, gets the information from his enslaved servant, Onesimus. He'd given him that name, as in Onesimus, meaning useful. Onesimus proved extremely useful. He said, well, in Africa, we've been doing this time out of mind, immemorially. And Cotton Mather took that on. He converted one physician, Zabdiel Boylston, and the blowback again was instantaneous. Only God can judge between who will live and who will die. Why should we listen to illiterate barbarians, really, when they tell us what they think is good for us? And a grenade was thrown into I think, was it Cotton Mather's partner? No, it was Zabdiel, mm-hmm, was it Cotton Mather's partner? Yeah. So there was a real, you know, there was a kind of storm of hatred, yeah, not unlike Fauci phobia now. You know, he has to have a security detail, and death threats happen pretty much all the time.
And there were very public debates over, yeah, this issue. If we think about Philadelphia, Ben Franklin was, right, very opposed in the beginning, yeah, to this practice. And then,
what did he say? Because actually he reminded me, And hate to say, I'd forgotten actually all about
that. Yeah, he did not believe that it. Well, he did not believe that it worked. I guess people thought it was dangerous, right, that it was not proven, that it could actually kill people. I'm sure it did kill some people in some instances, because I'm sure they didn't always get it right.
Well, we'll never know. I mean, some of those who actually in Britain, and indeed the great Angelo Gatti in France, said you really have to distinguish between people who have died from inoculation, mm-hmm, or those who have died after being inoculated. And that, is, of course, is still the case.
Right.
Still very contentious. By the way, Michael and I are drinking lemonade. I was so touched that only the Free Library would do this. The first person to write in English, actually, as he did, for a lay audience about inoculation of smallpox was Voltaire. He'd been in England in 1726-28, and he'd seen inoculation at work and adopted by the royal family, among others. But Voltaire had gone through a horrific case of smallpox, and at one point I can't even remember how many, it was like 100 gallons of lemonade. He attributed his survival to that. So just in case there's smallpox lurking There's some very dodgy characters right at the back, actually. But they're all wearing masks, so that's okay. But we have prophylactic lemonade here. Which is...
But to return... cheers to that. To return to Ben Franklin, he lost his son to smallpox in 1736. But then he also very publicly changed his mind.
Right.
And he said, I wish I had done this. I wish I had known. Yeah. But I guess sometimes we think of these very political debates over what to do and how to do it. Mm. We think of that as a modern phenomenon, but right. it is not. I mean, yeah. as long as we've had pandemics, they have turned into
true.
Political issues.
That's absolutely right. There is a difference of kind, almost, I think, actually, between the two sets of objections. I mean, in the 18th century, the objections were from a large number, but not all, of the clergy. I mean, some of the clergy in Britain in particular, and even occasionally in France, and very notably in Italy, moved from saying this is an outrageous usurpation of the divine will to saying really everything, including the mysterious wonder that is inoculation, has been designed by God, you know. So it's kind of... wonderful kind of, I don't know, Spinozist almost version of the way the natural world ultimately is not inconsistent with heavenly design. But now, what had not happened in the 18th century is this kind of rhetorical fetish about being robbed of our personal autonomy. So the kind of rhetoric of liberty was not really co-opted against the wisdom of science, you know, what was held to be the wisdom of science. Well, the 19th century is a moment, really, where even though things are extremely politicized, but there are real divisions within the medical community and indeed within the scientific community, for example, about whether or not cholera was contagious at all, whether or not cholera only arose in specific localities of where water supplies were fecally contaminated and therefore could not possibly be contagious. And those who correctly said, well, you're not going to get it if you go into a room with someone who has got cholera, but if you shake hands with him, this may very well be the end. Or, you know, even before the cholera, so-called coma vibrio, was discovered in 1883, knew really that upholstery on a railway train seat or on a steamship or something like that could actually carry a microbial pathogen.
Talk a bit about the toll cholera took during that time period. You gave us a picture of smallpox and just how devastating the impact was.
Right.
What about cholera?
Well, cholera was absolutely as terrifying. I mean, particularly the speed at which between contracting it and dying of it was a matter of, what, 2 or 3 days or something like that. It was really absolutely horrifying. So you really did want a prophylactic, really. There was not time for have a mitigating therapy. And, I mean, the first... There are two stages in the kind of scientific, political, scientific and institutional response. The first stage is the story told in one of the chapters of Marcel Proust's father. This is an extraordinary story. I knew a little bit about him, but not as much as I came to know Adrian Proust. I knew he was a doctor. I was sort of entertained by that, since he was the father to the most hypochondriac writer in all of European literary history, really. But I thought, you know, he's sort of a figure of either ominous paternal authority or almost absurdly sanctimonious pretentiousness in Proust. Although, as I discovered, rather movingly, father and son become extremely close towards the end of what would turn out to be the end of Adrian Proust's life. But Proust really... in this kind of tradition of French scientific paternalism that starts in the Ancien Régime and is reinforced both towards the end of the Revolution and the period of the Empire and in the early 19th century, where France sends engineers, scientists, and doctors to the Middle East. In that tradition, Adrien Proust was, because he was a contagionist, so-called, thought quarantine was absolutely essential. And he travels personally into the hottest of hotspots for cholera on the borders between Russia and Persia in particular. It's an extraordinary story. And then publishes his kind of map of the kind of geography of cholera, in effect. The British, of course, sorry to shout, as I'm wont to when the word British passes my lips. The British, of course, were not keen on this because one of the places where cholera was most intensively transmitted and most intensively contagious were on the very, very crowded boats going to the Hajj in Mecca from Muslim Asia, from India and Ceylon, Sri Lanka and Malaya and so on. But most of all, the British did not want to see trade interrupted between British Asia and the metropolitan home. So there was a tremendous amount of argument, two-part argument. One is that cholera is not contagious. All you have to do is decontaminate and disinfect the sources of its origins, wherever that was. And secondly, you know, and here we do get into kind of the way in which kind of classic liberal political philosophy colonize public health, it would sort of do no good. The economic harm you would do, hello, Governor of Florida right now, would be much, much worse than the good you could possibly do by quarantine containment. What was not thought to be possible was, until Louis Pasteur created a vaccine against rabies, was that there would be a prophylactic vaccine against cholera. And that's the story of the sort of hero of the book, really, a man called Valdemar Hafki, an Ukrainian Jew, who manages against all the odds to create a successful anti-cholera vaccine in the Pasteur Institute in the summer of 1892, and then takes it to India. It's sort of an extraordinary story.
And did they fully understand the causes of cholera at that time?
Well, yeah, the cholera, so-called coma vibrio, is just discovered. It's isolated and identified by the great bacteriologist Robert Cook, who has a laboratory. It's the other pole to Pasteur in Berlin. And yes. He actually isolates the coma vibrio in Alexandria and then in Calcutta. So by the time that Hafkin, it's known what this pathogen looks like, really. And it's also known, because of Ilya Metchnikoff's work, that there is such a thing as an immune system, and the immune system can produce what Metchnikoff calls phagocytes, eating cells, in effect, white blood cells. It will produce antibodies, in effect, that will ingest and actually vacuum clean as well your vascular system of this. So, but they are in the... There's always a lag, which can be, which we all know about now. There's a lag between scientific breakthrough and the medical profession in particular, the kind of guild mentality of the medical profession taking this on board. Remember that, you know, they were still correctly in debt to Joseph Lister for understanding sepsis and what an antiseptic could do. So then, military-style disinfection with carbolic acid and lime wash and so on then became a kind of, you know, biblical sort of default mode of dealing with any kind of massive outbreak of infectious disease. So it was taken on board, but Hafkin in India was attacked for not having a medical degree, which he didn't. He had a doctorate in microbiological science, but it was held... His kind of knowledge was held to be suspicious. I mean, there have been attacks from people like Rand Paul on the whole discipline of virology as dangerous scientists who don't know what they're doing. A lab leak was definitely the origin. I think it was definitely the origin. And they shouldn't be allowed, really, to go gain of function, should not be allowed to happen at all. Without gain of function, we wouldn't know what's around the corner in terms of the dangers that the next particular virus might have for us.
How was the idea of the immune system received at first? When you think about it, it's almost this war that happens inside of your body with the good guys fighting the bad guys and all of this. So how did people take to that?
You know, the major institutions of science do accept it, actually, quite as distinct from the medical profession, quite quickly from, you know, Russia through France and Germany and Vienna. And so far from there being a kind of long delay of skepticism, what I describe in the book is a sort of an extension of great power politics in being, you know, they send teams of people. When bubonic plague breaks out in China, the Japanese, as well as the Germans and the French, again, tellingly, not the British, no, I didn't shout this time, to China in order to try and isolate the plague bacillus. And a man, extraordinary man called Alexandre Yersin, Swiss, actually, but thought of to his fury as French, but he'd been a figure for a while, great figure in the Pasteur Institute, junior. So he isolates it, which is why it's called the Bacillus Yersinii now.
And so
they do take it on board, but the issue is actually, as always, can you get those who need to execute the application to have the kind of imprimatur of the medical profession?
Were these efforts to go to these places, to understand what was happening, to find a vaccine, is this a humanitarian quest? Is it more how to protect our own interests here? What were some of the motives?
I think the one wasn't... it's certainly the case that then, as of now, the interest was absolutely in safeguarding your own population, mm-hmm. particularly your colonial power. You know, would this come back to haunt you in your own metropolitan home? But I have to say, what was striking about the international sanitary conferences and also in the crowd of different scientists, as you know, Japanese scientists were very important. In fact, to this day, a great scientist called Kitisato Shibasaburo, the Japanese, insists that he was the first person, he probably was by a matter of a week or so, to discover the plague bacillus. But the specimens he'd sent actually were contaminated, and therefore they were not accepted as reliable, whereas Yersin's were. But my point is actually, I was struck by the fact that there was probably less suspicion, actually, between national scientific communities. There was rivalry and competition, mm-hmm. but the differences and conflicts happened over basic theories of pathogenesis. I mean, a very great microbiologist called Pettenkofer in Berlin was a kind of rival of Robert Koch, and he still insisted that even though he accepted the existence of pathogenic microbes and viruses and bacteria and bacilli and so on, he also insisted that whether or not they would be lethal depended on atmospheric disturbances or swampy ground. And, you know, yeah, you're quite right. You know, we laugh at that now, actually, but he was such a kind of institutional, thought of as an institutionally wise figure. So those were the battles that being fought out intra-scientifically, really. But people were... You know, again, the possibility of achieving immunity through vaccination was you know, taken on board surprisingly, I think, mm-hmm. actually. Which is not to say that when things might go wrong, the kind of sudden reaction against it, which we, you know, see now. I mean, for example, I don't think things are going wrong with the COVID vaccines, but it is quite true that as a prophylactic, as you get a vaccination and you will never get COVID, we all know that's not true. Many of you, I'm sure, have had both, as I have. What is absolutely indisputably true is that vaccination is an incredible mitigator of severity. That there is no statistical doubt whatsoever. So in a sense, there's often a kind of moment of catch-up mm-hmm. and correction and modification.
I want to turn to one of the big figures in your book, which is Waldemar Hafkin, and his role in finding the cholera vaccine. So talk a bit about his background.
Right.
How did his scientific journey start? Right. Where did it take him?
Yeah, he's a remarkable figure, and I've been accused quite correctly by reviewers of being a bit too much in love with him. There's an incredible photograph. Two photographs are taken at the height of his fame in 1899 by a very interesting woman photographer called Angelina Ackland, who was the daughter of the emeritus professor of pathology at Oxford. And he is strikingly handsome, and she makes him even more in the way she photographs him. So I begin that chapter with, goodness, isn't he beautiful, or something like that. not meaning that I am, you know, merrily in love. I probably am a bit, but meaning that she and people who saw Hafkin in person absolutely felt, you know, beautiful on the outside, beautiful on the inside. But Hafkin was, he was an Odessan Jew, a Ukrainian Jew, born indeed, grew up in Odessa, which had a history of pogroms from the 1870s onwards. It was not a secular family, it was not a super Orthodox family. Odessa was one of the very few places where Jews could go to university and receive a professional training, and were taught Russian. And learned in Russian as well. Interestingly, the Hafkin, he had a grandfather who taught him Hebrew and religion. So they were neither irreligious nor certainly not super Orthodox. He goes to the so-called Novorossiya University in Odessa, the new Russian university, in 1880-81 to read maths and physics. And that is the year which some of you, I'm sure, will know that Tsar Alexander II was assassinated by a terrorist, mostly student organization called Narodnaya Volya, the People's Will. And Hafkin was certainly not part of that assassination plot, but a young Jewish woman was. And the assassination of the Tsar was blamed on the Jews. And even though Odessa was a place where a fairly enlightened place for Jews to live, they knew another very bad pogrom was coming down the line. And Hafkin was part of a group of Jews who armed the community with guns for the first time. They also, because they knew a pogrom would happen, rather wonderfully, I think, the little group of students went to the toughest of the tough in the Odessa Jewish community to kind of mobilize them into an armed self-defense group, and that would be kosher butchers. You know, you really don't want to mess with them. My grandfather was one of them, Mark, actually. And they had their own synagogue, actually, in which Hafkin's best friend preached a sermon. So Hafkin is caught with a gun on him three times and thrown into the slammer, and he's rescued by his doctor father, Metchnikoff himself, who gets the Nobel Prize for his work in immunology, really for discovering how the immune system works. Metchnikoff is from a converted Jewish family, but he has great connections among the super few plutocratic Jews in Petersburg and through them to the court. And he's sprung from prison, although the secret police in Russia start to compile what becomes a very weighty file on this young man. In the end, Metchnikoff's own career is compromised by helping Hafkin, among other things, and Metchnikoff's own sense of suspicion about the Okhrana, the secret police in Russia. And Metchnikoff tells Hafkin, do science, you have to stop politics. And when Metchnikoff goes to the Institut Pasteur in its first year in 1888-89, he ends up bringing Hafkin there. And Hafkin is a devotee of French. I mean, he's versatile in many languages. And it's 1889. It's the centennial of the French Revolution. The Eiffel Tower is built. He's in love. His notebooks, the archives are in Jerusalem, and they are just a wonderful thing. His notebooks are full, on the one hand, of elaborate preparatory notes for the world's first experimental course in microbiology taught by Pasteur's second-in-command, Émile Roux, and on the other hand, lengthy passages from the novels of Balzac and short stories by Maupassant and poems by Verlaine and so on. So it's really absolutely amazing. And he is given, he's a lowly worm, he's an assistant librarian, there's no place for him. So he does his preparatory scientific work during the day, but he then is, you know, he decides that he will do what was thought to be impossible, namely apply the kind of methodology that Pasteur had used to create a vaccine against rabies to cholera. And it takes him 2.5 years and endless false starts, and through a complicated series of serial passages through guinea pigs, 39 of them to be precise, producing the kind of, it's a very delicate thing. You needed enough of the pathogen to kickstart the immune system. He knows how the immune system works, but not enough that it's going to kill you. Mm-hmm. So pretty much smallpox, but now intelligently based on the scientific groundwork. And then in July 1892, he's got what he wants, and it's working in guinea pigs and a variety of animals. In other words, they're subcutaneously injected with the vaccine, and they don't, and they've also been given in a different part of their body a dose of cholera, and they don't die of it at all. And then he does, and it's a very important part because actually, you know, it's all about success at persuasion. It's about communication. He's the first person to vaccinate himself, and then he rounds up some friends who you have to say must have been very friendly to want to try this. And there's a young new friend who's an Englishman called Ernest Hanbury Hankin, who's a kind of wonderful figure. And Hankin follows every single step of the procedure and the research, experimental research that had gone to make it, and publishes it in the British Medical Journal. And it's done. But what is not done is that cholera is receding fast. It's not completely gone. There's another outbreak, in famous one in Hamburg in 1896, I think it was. But everybody in the Pasteur Institute knows that you need to go to a population where cholera can be a sudden epidemic, and that would be in Asia, in India. And
so
he goes there.
When they vaccinated themselves,
yeah.
I mean,
they
were not exposed to cholera at that time, so they were testing it more to see that it was safe, or what was the thinking?
They were exposed to the extent in which they're introducing it into their perfectly healthy bodies, the
right.
same way that inoculation and vaccination, cow vaccination, worked. So, I will say that what I've not said yet, and I say in the book, is that Hafkin isn't exactly the first person to do it. There was a Catalan, sort of self-taught scientist, and Dr. Gorjame Ferran, who tries it in Spain, but he doesn't do any kind of randomized trials, which Hafkin knows he must do. That's why he wants to go to India to do it. And there's a particularly terrible moment where Ferran vaccinates a convent of nuns, and about a third of them die, and also the son of a friend of his dies of it. So Hafkin going on was well aware of this and knew that, you know, when he vaccinates himself, it's an incredible throw of the dice. And his friends knew that as well. But he was, you know, all those midnight work with the guinea pigs and the confirmation of results. It was really exhaustively. I mean, I will say this, there's actually a very nice review forthcoming at some point in the New York Times, but I saw the text today. But it says some snarky things, but hey, but the extraordinary thing is that the reviewer says Hafkin home-brewed the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
He said it was sort of homemade vaccine, which sounds like he's making it in his bathtub or something. He is in fact obeying the most rigorous protocols of modern, you know, microbiology. So
yeah.
So he goes through the most exacting standards he can possibly do. And then when he gets to India, he has what he wants. In other words, he has only volunteers got the vaccine in India, but they were in Calcutta slums, they were in very poor parts of India, or they were in military cantonments or even in prisons. So he can do what we now recognize as randomized trials. In other words, person A gets the vaccine, person B doesn't, person C gets the vaccine, and so on. So, and whatever the British in India were guilty of, which was plenty, they were not guilty of under-collecting data.
Mm-hmm.
So me sitting in lockdown in the Hudson Valley is absolutely courtesy of the Wellcome Collection and government records in Britain. Could read all these extraordinarily detailed, sometimes street by street, house by house records of how the vaccine worked or how, in some cases, it didn't work.
Mm. I think we're opening things up to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, just raise your hand and we'll start right there.
Thanks for coming forgivingly to the home of the Declaration of Independence.
The what, sorry?
The home of the Declaration of Independence. I've been a fan for a long time, and I really just have a different kind of a question. Are there any secrets or tips to writing well and profoundly about so many different topics?
No. Oh, I don't know. It's a lovely question, but everybody will, you know, give you their own answer. And it's very kind of you to assume that's what I do, or to characterize me in that way. I, you know, The last thing my father ever said to me before he died is, be brave. And I think what he meant by that, and he'd seen two of my books come out, I think what he meant about is, you know, follow your star in some sense. Do not, if you're a non-fiction writer, do not necessarily obey the conventions, and don't just talk inside the echo chamber of academia. Nothing wrong with scholarly discussion. Absolutely do it a lot, and it's to be commended. But, you know, sometimes different subjects, for example, I mean, you know, so I've written on many different things, but in many, I now see, and I don't think I was consciously trying to really adopt a different kind of voice, but the different kind of voice adopted me. In other words, the voice in the book I wrote about the French Revolution, Citizens, there I suppose I was a little conscious of that. I'd given lectures on the French Revolution in Cambridge a lot, but I was really interested in Dutch history, but particularly the moment when the French Revolution invaded the Netherlands in the name of granting them liberty. But it was a wonderful publisher at Penguin who said you really should be, as the bicentennial approach, said you should be writing such a book. And I thought, should I? And what I did was actually go and read. I in any case, immersed myself and, you know, in my own peers and contemporaries' work at the French Revolution. I went and read what had been written and published in the centennial of the French Revolution in 1889 by people whose parents or grandparents had been alive more or less at the time or shortly after. And there that's why I call it a chronicle of the French Revolution. There I wanted somehow, without abandoning analytical argument, I wanted to get the kind of diction in a way. And that led me to understanding the importance of rhetoric itself, different manners of speech, as a kind of inflammatory weapon in revolutionary politics. So that was one case. In another case, the book I wrote about, called Rough Crossings, about the enslaved people in America who were cynically promised by the British their freedom if they joined the British Army, the Loyalist Army, and 10,000 of them did. It's an extraordinary story. I wouldn't have written that book had I not encountered the journal in the New York Historical Society, the young 27-year-old lieutenant, who was a brother of the abolitionist Thomas Clarkson. So the young man is called John Clarkson, who took it upon himself to gather these black loyalists who were very badly treated by British white loyalists in Nova Scotia after the war was over, and take them across the ocean, hence the title of the book, Rough Crossings, to found what became Sierra Leone. So it was the gripping sense, really, of that one document that made me sort of want to be a kind of historical ventriloquist for John Clarkson. So each task really comes with its own sensibility, I think, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think you just sort of have to be open to cultivating that if you can. Go with the flow.
Here's our next question.
Thank you. It's very interesting. I was wondering, is it known if in ancient times, in biblical times, were epidemics such as you've been describing in your book? And then I have a little second part.
Well, that's a lovely question. It's that certainly, you know, the first famous descriptions of what is clearly a bubonic plague occur in the 6th century AD, as it were, CE, in the reign of the Emperor Justinian. And recently there have been attempts to actually discredit the possibility that it really was now. But there have been counter-attempts, which are much more convincing, that there really was a very, very serious outbreak of plague in the 6th century AD, CE. The Bible is a very, very difficult source because most of it is written many hundreds of years after the events it purports to describe. And it depends on how you read your Hebrew. You know, there are clearly, it describes leprosy, for example. When the plague of Egypt is, plagues of Egypt, they are, you know, there's cattle murrain and boils and frogs and so on. You can't develop an etiology from the Bible. It's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing, but it's a staggering exercise in poetic license and invented memory, really. So.
difference, or what is the difference between an epidemic and a pandemic?
Oh, well, it's a very good question, which I've never really been able to figure out. Pandemic just means everywhere, really. An epidemic can occur within a circumscribed area, even if it's as big as India, but usually it's described in a more circumscribed area. Pandemic is exactly what we've been through with COVID, where from one end of the world to the other, it happens, or in a very, very large, so that's semantic difference thing, of order of magnitude, really, and geography.
Thank you so much for coming.
Pleasure, I love being here.
As you've been exploring and retelling these stories of so many epidemics and pandemics, whether you have seen whether there's some particular dimension that leads to forgetfulness, if you will, or that
leads to what? Sorry,
leads us to forget about these, for them to us to disappear for moments, even as we walk in cities now that 2 years ago were empty.
Right.
Whether there's something as you look across this history that seems to be a particular dimension, either the scale of death, the nature of transmission, other features that speak to that.
No, that's a wonderful question. The classic, if that's the right word to call it, of the Black Death, you know, begins in 1348, famously, and does not really end until the late 17th century. And in fact, more accurately, it doesn't really end until 1722, 23, when there's a terrible outbreak of the Black Death in Marseille. I mean, a really terrible outbreak. But that's a lot of centuries. And the plague releases its grip for 2 or 3 years, and then it will pounce horrifically in England in 1665. Venice lost a third of its population in 1630-31. It was catastrophic beyond belief. But there's a constant, you know, from Boccaccio through to Daniel Defoe's novel, Journal of the Plague Year, there is a kind of a level of cultural expectation of living with or trying to escape from the Black Death. Other epidemics and pandemics have a much more kind of compressed lifespan. I mean, cholera begins in earnest in Europe, at least, in 1819, and is sort of going away in the 1880s, really, 1890s. That's a long time, I suppose, but it's far less long than the experience of the Black Death. So There is. I mean, well, if you take the so-called Spanish flu, which began in Kansas, by the way, as far as we know, you know, it's natural human instinct to want not to be terrified. Repression is a great and wonderful thing. But, of course, the scientific community, I haven't read it yet, the transcript, but Ghebreyesus, the head of the World Health Organization, gave a press conference today about preparations for future pandemics. We now have an extraordinary community worldwide of epidemiologists and virologists and who are doing nothing else but thinking about, actually, what to do on the expectation that something else unpleasant is going to be coming down the pike. And the early part of the book is sort of, I suppose, not quite of a piece with the rest of the book, but the very first chapter is about an ongoing huge problem, namely the destruction of the barriers between wild animal populations and densely inhabited human populations, which has led to the transmission of extremely deadly Ebola and AIDS and H1N1, and, you know, some contained like Ebola, AIDS not, all coming through that particular route. And we're in a time of kind of demographic explosion, so that the reason, one of the reasons why the normal barriers have gone down, it also includes the extraordinary explosion in the trading of wild animals for pseudo-pharmaceutical purposes or just for bushmeat. This goes on and on as populations in big cities like Lagos in Nigeria, for example, Johannesburg in South Africa, push against reservoirs of wild animal populations, the dangers, you know, become more and more serious and more aggravated. And it's not that the scientific community is not paying attention to it. They are, but they run up against all the economic and political barriers and misgivings that you can well imagine. Like, it's just like, you know, the link between climate change. I mean, for example, climate change is extending the breeding season of mosquito populations that that carry dengue fever and West Nile virus. And on the other hand, you know, within the next few years, if not sooner, there will be a vaccine against malaria, which would be an incredible thing, I think, really. Yeah. I was saying to Macon, I mean, we're in this extraordinary moment, a very free Library of Philadelphia moment, where the human condition is one of staggeringly unprecedented technical ingenuity. And at the same time, we're just a kind of cartload of barely evolved paranoias, prejudices as well. We're stuck with this split personality.
Could you talk about the history of blaming it on foreigners? I mean, it seems to be kind of a theme. Certainly, it's happened in this go round. But does that happen all the time?
And the anti-Semitism.
Right. Certainly, Hafkin was constantly described, particularly when he hits a terrible wall in that. He's the person who creates the world's first mass production vaccine facility in Bombay, as it was then known, in 1899. And this produces millions of doses of vaccine, which travel all through India and beyond India to Africa and Malaya, as it was then, Australia and so on. But in 1902, there's a case. I'm going to come to your question, I promise, in a second. But there's a case of a terrible case in a village in the Punjab called Malkawal, where 19 people die of tetanus poisoning as a result of a contaminated batch of vaccine. And Hafkin immediately gets the blame, even though the Commission of Inquiry, without telling him, knows that what had actually happened in the village was that the person, one of the preparers of the vaccines, had dropped the forceps that were used to extract the India rubber stopper from the neck of the bottle. The vial had been dropped on the ground. All these vaccinations in rural districts happened in the open air. And instead of passing it through heat sterilization, the Institut Pasteur norm had merely sluiced the forceps in a dilute preparation of carbolic acid, and that's where the contamination happened. Hafkin did know, however, that if in fact the contamination had happened at source in the production facility in Bombay, when the bottle was opened, it took 2 or 3 weeks to get to this particular place in the Punjab, there would have been a terrible, violent stench of odour characteristically happen with the growth of tetanus toxins, and no one had smelled anything at all. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of convinced that it had not been his fault. But, and here's the answer, he's instantly thought of as the Russian Jew. The double penalty there. The Russians are thought by the British at the end of the 19th century to be massing above the Khyber Pass, were ill-intentioned about to pour down into the valley of the Indus. And he is indeed an outsider. He has no medical degree. He's Jewish. He's a stranger. He's socially awkward. All those things do come into play to such an extent that the Viceroy, Lord Curzon, blames Hafkin for bringing the honour and integrity of the British Raj into disrepute, and says he needs to be tried, convicted, and hanged for what he's done to British India. So that indeed, and that sort of sense of suspicion of Jewish doctors goes back a very, very long way to the Middle Ages. The University of Padua was one of the few places where Jews could go and get, again, a degree in medicine, in high Christian Middle Ages. And they were thought of, you know, Maimonides was known about. Jewish doctors at the end of the Middle Ages and the early modern period were thought of as possessors of esoteric and occult knowledge, particularly about anti-venom secrets, antidotes to poisoning. And poisoning is big business if you know your Borgia history and history of the Renaissance. So Jews are hired as super doctors, but they're also thought to be super dangerous. And famously, a Murano doctor, physician to Queen Elizabeth I, was accused of being part of a Spanish plot to poison her and was tried and executed for that. And so you live on kind of razor's edge of special favour because of your advanced and semi-secret knowledge of medical things which non-Jews were not supposed to know about. And this is all spurious for the most part, this access to secret knowledge. It meant knowing Arabic very often, between success and paying a terrible price. And I think in, you know, that then feeds into modern paranoias as well, not just for Jews. But that's why the book is called, partly punningly, in a rather lead-booted way, Foreign Bodies.
I want to thank you so much for spending the evening with us.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.